Hello and welcome to Real Bible Stories. Join us as we deep dive into the historic, religious, cultural, political, and emotional context surrounding the real lives of real people in the Bible and the stories we've all grown to love. Welcome back. I'm your host, Imran Ward, joined by my wife, Selena.
Hey.
And our teacher, Ryan Brown.
Welcome back, everyone.
Okay, so now we're back on the gravy train talking about the parables of Jesus Christ. I know we had that break last week, but now we're back. So the next 2 weeks, we're going to be spending time in Matthew 18, and I'm going to hand over to Ryan to give a little bit more context about the sermon that Jesus was teaching at the time. But if you open up your Bibles, Matthew 18 is where we're going to be. So this parable this week is actually super popular. It's in a bunch of songs. It's basically a children's story is when I first heard it and first learned it. But if you haven't heard the parable of the lost sheep, we're going to go through it today and in a lot more detail and context than you probably were taught in your Sunday school class. So,
well, and like we were talking before this, it may ruin some of those
songs
for you. like Christ, what they're singing about in regards to this parable is not really what the parable is kind of
actually getting
to,
after
talking to, but I mean, but we'll get into that. I don't know what it is. There's something about having presupposed understanding of what a story in the
presupposed.
Bible.
We're starting off with the 10-cent word.
Yeah, well, it's something that you think something's about and you realize it's not about. Sometimes it makes us angry, but also sometimes I think it brings more clarity. So I'm hoping it's the latter for everyone. But Matthew 18. If you're not familiar with this chapter, this is what you would guess call the chapter of church discipline.
So, church discipline.
Yeah, church discipline. So, if you're familiar with the Qumran community, they were the where I call the Dead Sea Scrolls were found.
Where was that they were found?
So it was in the Negev Desert, right across where it describes John the Baptist and his ministry is where the Qumran community is, and they actually. Many believe John the Baptist spent time in this community. They were kind of essentially what they were was a, I don't want to say an outcast community, but they were, it was like a bunch of children of priests who realized that the priesthood had gotten vastly corrupted.
Mm-hmm.
So they recognized that what the priesthood should be is not what it was.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
And what they ended up doing is they went out and kind of established their own community out in the Negev Desert. And it's pretty far out there. I mean, you know, because our Israel trip, we were there too, and it's hot. It is.
That part of the desert?
Oh, yeah. It is really hot. But it's right by the Dead Sea. So, like, the closest body of water is, I think, about 5 miles away. So they would have to, like, do caravans just to go get water and bring it
like
in.
Like, no underwater aquifers or anything like that at all?
No, and it's about five.
Why would you even live like that?
Talks,
the whole point was to live near water. It's usually where you find civilizations.
So, like, well, when you talk about, like, John the Baptist was one who ate locusts and, you know, was kind of in that lifestyle, that was the whole Qumran community. And
they were all kind
of
like that.
If you notice, John the Baptist, he was the son of a priest, too. Right.
I didn't know that at all.
Yeah, his dad was, remember Zechariah, who received the revelation on probably the Day of Atonement.
Makes sense, yeah.
They cast lots, and he was the one who were to go into the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement, and that's when he received the first revelation, really kind of talking about John the Baptist that leads into Christ, and he didn't believe him, so he made him mute until he was born.
Yeah.
Right, so Zechariah, John the Baptist, his dad was a priest. So when you look at the Qumran community, you see that it's kind of like this, the children of priests or orphans. So the reason I bring that up is because the Qumran community, which is vastly associated to John the Baptist, they found in the Dead Sea Scrolls what they would call a manual of discipline. So there's this idea that, because, you know, when we think of disciples now, our thoughts and minds kind of go to followers of Christ, right?
Quick question on what you mean by discipline. You mean the expectations of how to act discipline or how to punish?
Well, that's what I was going to talk about. So when we talk about, like, disciples, right? We like modern, we talk about somebody who follows Christ or is a believer in Christ. So therefore, yeah, we're a disciple of Christ. They view disciples completely different. There's a teacher, you're a student, and you are learning and practicing a discipline, right? This is a discipline you're practicing. So it's not just that you're being taught things and being, you know, given truth, but here are disciplines you must add, you know, that you must
we talk about with that with like almost like doctors and lawyers and stuff. Like they're different disciplines. Are you a heart surgeon? Are you a general practitioner? Are you those as disciplines as well?
The Marine Corps, right? The discipline of war, and there's certain disciplines that you follow. You know, you have to shave your face every day.
Yeah.
You know why? So your gas mask, you know, doesn't break a seal. You know, there's certain discipline, right, that you must practice, possess a certain discipline to the discipline mm-hmm. of war, right? And so the same idea. So just like how they had a manual of discipline, which was, it's kind of like this order of these are things you practice, but there's also things that there's standards. And when you break certain standards, like what is your process or how do you deal with certain situations when you know, maybe you break that discipline, right? So okay. Matthew 18 really kind of acts as Christ's manual of discipline for the church. He says this is, there are certain expectations of the church. The church is expected to be holy. You are saints. You're expected to be just. You're expected to love people. There's all this expectation.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when you break that? So what happens when a believer in the church is not practicing the discipline the way they should? How do you deal with those believers and those people, mm-hmm. right? So for the next two parables, we're going to be in Matthew 18 because each one is talking to a different point, but it's all wrapped up under the guise of a community of faith. How does the community within the kingdom, you know, how are they supposed to, what kind of behavior are they supposed to follow, and what sort of process do we follow to correct, you know, improper behavior yeah. within the church? So I think the biggest point to make over the next two parables is that this is all in the context of church discipline. So it assumes something. It assumes that you're already what?
A member.
A member of the church, right? So keep that in mind, because particularly in the one we're going to talk about today, it gets misapplied, I think, sometimes. It gets used as a parable describing God's character towards people outside of the church, you know, those who are lost.
Mm.
And you know,
really
it's not that that
lost within the faith.
That is a character of God, right? But
yeah.
That is not, for this parable, really what the parable is speaking to. But does that make sense?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So to really lead into this parable before you read it, Selena, we have to kind of do some leveling here. One of the first things that Christ opens up with in Matthew 18 really opens up with is a question from the disciples. It says verse 1 that at the time the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" All right, so here's this question: who's the greatest? Who of everybody? Is it Moses? Is it Isaiah? Is it you know, they asked this question earlier.
Okay, so they're asking out of men, who is the greatest? Because I was like, isn't God the greatest in heaven? Like,
right. Well, it's kind of a simple.
That's an easy one.
That's an easy one. But that's like the children's Awana answer. Jesus.
Yeah.
You're right.
You're right. Duh.
No. So yeah.
Was it the sons of thunder asking that?
It says the disciples.
Okay.
So it was kind of like a general statement.
Okay.
So who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And calling to him a child, he put him in the midst of them and said, "Truly I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom." So the first thing is that Jesus says, really in verses 1 through 5 leading into this, he says, first, to even enter the kingdom, we must be like children.
Yep.
We must be like children. And this child motif throughout this is synonymous with sheep that we'll also see in play in this chapter. Okay, so when you hear him talking about like the character of children, it's also the same association
to the character of sheep,
right? Mm. But continuing, it says, verse 5, "Whoever receives one such child, my name receives me. But whoever causes one of these little ones to believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to have a great milestone fastened around his neck and be drowned in the depth of the sea." So the first, he says that we must be like sheep or be like these little ones, right? what he's talking about is little ones are ones that are, it's people who are like these children, right? So we kind of miss this contextually in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
In our culture, if you have a child, that child is really the center of the family in your life, right? Like it dictates schedule. It dictates like you're going to soccer practice.
I would tell Selena about my mom and my dad growing up that I never thought I was the center of attention or anything like that. My mom definitely sacrificed some things for me, but I'll give her the example of dinner time. Like I would complain about the food that we have, and my mom says, "I don't cook for you. I cook for your father. I just make enough so that you can eat. If you don't want to eat, then you can go to sleep hungry."
They came from
the Caribbean.
Right?
Yeah, so it's a totally different cultural approach to raising children.
So yeah, that probably this isn't true of I guess you. I would say that by and large, for most of at least America, though. I know this is a generality. I'm just saying that culturally, like
families that have been here for a couple hundred years,
yeah, you have
children, the culture,
like you have children, and like okay, we got to go to soccer practice or baseball practice, and from baseball we got to go to piano, and now from piano we got to go. Like children kind of drive the schedule of a family in many regards, right? In their culture, though, that wasn't the case at all. Children, and maybe more associated to your experience,
how the Caribbean was,
is that. One, children were very vulnerable, right? And they were the least powerful. Children had no power at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, period. Like they're a child. Children, they were trusting and eager to learn. But because they weren't the center, children were generally like, I call it, they were ready to love and ready to be loved. So because of the way that the culture of very, you know, adult centric, you know, you the child was there to support the parents.
Mm-hmm.
The parents weren't there necessarily to support the child, right? So
yeah, my dad would tell me stories of him walking the sheep every morning. So mm-hmm. I think my dad has 12 siblings, something like that. The women were really working and make sure the house was clean and stuff like that, and then the men were it was all girls. My dad only has one brother, so it's two guys. And so my dad's job was to take the sheep up the mountain in the morning, and he'd go from there to school, walk back from school, get the sheep, bring them back home. And he did that every day. There was never an expectation that, you know, that the parents worked to like make the child's life easier. It was like, hey, you're here to supplement like what we're already doing in the house.
And that's the exact same culture, right? Like that's the exact same thing with them because, I wrote it down here, but essentially children were not looked up to, but looked after. Right. So you weren't, where the child could be, you know, the center pride of the family or, you know, like they were viewed as a burden. You know what I mean? Like this was a burden to the family. So as a burden, you need to carry your weight.
Exactly. Yep.
And you need to participate in making sure the family has what it needs and mm-hmm. does what it needs, right?
And that's how they learn a trade and stuff too. It's not like they had like an elementary school, middle school they were sending them to, you know?
Yeah, I'm not saying that this is necessarily wrong. I'm saying that it's just different mm-hmm. than what much of,
wrong at all,
you know, but so anyways, they were looked after, they were subject to the elders. They were not highly regarded in society, right? So as a child, when he says that we need to be like children, he's just saying you need to take the same lowly, humble position that a child has, where you're eager to learn, you're eager to be loved, but you're also eager to support, you're willing to support, you're subject to elders, you are participating in the family.
Yeah.
Right? So when we talk about being, you know, the church, the ecclesia, often referred to as the family of God, you need to be participating in the family, in the needs of the family and you know, making the family in a stronger position, right?
You're not just waiting to receive stuff from your Heavenly Father.
And you could see this, right? You could see almost culturally the way we kind of place children at the center where parents are there supporting them.
There's a lot of science behind recent science that talks about how that's kind of problematic for kids that are coming of age now. because they were so kind of coddled growing up. And then they're...
Well, this is how it translates, is that when they, as in terms of believers participating in God's family,
mm-hmm.
now they're like, well, I come to church to be taken care of. I don't come to church to take care of people, or I'm not here to participate in the ministry of this. I'm here to receive and benefit from the ministry of the church, not participate in the ministry of the church. You see what I'm saying?
And you're saying that kind of can come from the a misunderstanding because of the familial upbringing in the culture.
I would say that because culturally the dynamic of the family's changed. You know, when we talk about the family of God, and you see that same sort of approach get applied to the family of God too, where,
mm-hmm.
well, no, you're here to put on church programs for me, right?
Yeah.
For me, where mm-hmm. we're in this culture, a child was like just like the what you said with your dad, right? Like, no, you play a role in this family,
yeah.
and your job at this point is to go take care of the goat or the sheep, right?
Take the sheep up the hill.
And take the,
take your behind to school. Come back, bring back every single one of them sheep.
Right, right. Everybody had a job contributing. Yeah. And he's saying you need to be like children in this regard where, you know, that is your heart, okay? So, but does that make sense? Children also, if you think about it, are not concerned about money or fame or power or influence.
What about these kids these days, you know?
Well,
TikTok.
They care
these
about
gamer,
iPad.
Gamer kids. Yeah, these 13-year-old millionaires playing video games.
Oh. But he says, though, whoever receives these little ones in his name, that's, you know, in verse 5.
Maybe he's talking about preteens. Him. I think he's talking preteens, right?
I don't know. He said little ones.
He says little ones. I'm going to say like less than 10 before they have like a sense of self, because then they could really be concerned with some of these things. I remember I wanted some money by the time I was in middle school. I was aware of what money was, and I was aware I wanted some. I was aware that women like men that had money. I was like, and by middle school, I was like, this is something I need to make sure I'm getting my hands on.
I think this more central point here, is culturally understanding where a child was placed in that community. And when he says you need to be like those children,
mm-hmm.
we need to understand culturally what that meant was that you need to be willing to serve and not with this expectation that you be served, right? Not that you don't get served sometimes, but you need to have the approach and the mindset that I am here to serve, I'm here to help the family, but I'm also eager to learn, I'm also eager to love people, right? Children are very open, right? It's incredible, like, in terms of socialization. You know, we'll go over to like a friend's house and they'll have, you know, some kids who are somewhat the same age as mine, but our kids have never met. And they have this kind of awkward, like, they kind of just look at each other really weird, you mm-hmm. know, and they're kind of uncomfortable and they just awkwardly stare at each other. And then one of them will eventually say, hey, or our parent will be like, hey, why don't you go show them your room, or, you know, go show them your whatever. And they're like, you want to go see my room? And they're like, kind of really awkwardly,
yeah.
just kind of nodding away. Sure. And they go in there, and then by the time we leave, they're like best friends.
Aww. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that's how kids work. Yeah. Where we, as like adults, my wife tries this. She you know, tries to do the double dates, because she'll find somebody that she really, really likes, you know, and mm-hmm. and she'll be like, hey, let's go out as a couple. Mm-hmm. So, because if you and him become friends and I'm already friends with her, mm-hmm. like, we could have these.
This is going to be great.
You know, and it's really hard as a couple, because like, we'll go out and I'll be like, yeah, I mean, I didn't have a problem with them, but it wasn't, you know, yeah, I don't know. I mean, she's like, well, do you want to go hang out with them again? I'm like, well, I
would. Do you want to see my room?
Like, well, I would hang out with them again, but do you want to? And I'm just like, well, one, men are not like women in this regard, right? Like, men don't operate that way. Like,
yeah.
Sure, like, but I don't know, you know, and she, it always frustrates her. She's like, you know, and there's some people I'm like, I didn't really like him that much, or, you know, at least in a social sense.
Yeah.
Or then there's guys like I get along with really great, but then the women don't click, right? So
yeah, it's a different
adults
dynamic.
Adults socialize different, and
people
kids,
also don't,
like,
need that many friends. You have like one or two people that you care about, and then you've got your spouse. Like, that's taking up all your time already.
Like, well, even when you have children, it's like I feel like I have very little time to socialize with them, let alone with a bunch of other people. Yeah. You know. But anyways, my point is that, you know, to be like children to enter God's kingdom, right? He mm-hmm. says, unless you're like these little children, you don't even get to enter the kingdom, let alone who's greatest, right? Mm-hmm. But if you keep reading, and this is all leading to this parable, okay? So just track with me for a second. In verse 6, it says, but whoever causes one of these little ones to believe in me to sin, right? So whoever causes one of these ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to have a great milestone fastened around his neck. Millstone fastened around his neck and be drowned in the depths of the sea. Woe to the world for the temptations to sin, for it is necessary that temptations come, but woe to the one by whom the temptation comes. So essentially, he's essentially saying is that for those believers within our family, within the church, okay, so he says, first, he must be like these sheep, these little ones, but second, we better not be the source that leads somebody in the church to sin. And he uses very harsh language for those who in the church lead others in the church to sin. And you would think that, like, well, is this really a problem? And it is. I would say just
yes. It's to the point where it's deeper, like in the culture, it's like a cultural joke in some areas with like the Catholic priests and stuff. Like, it's to the point where non-believers just see it as like a joke where people are being betrayed by other people in the church.
Well, it's not just that. We're not just talking about like hypocrisy in terms of like, so next week we will talk about church leadership. Okay. Mm-hmm. What he's talking about here though, is that if you are a believer in Christ, but then you are not just that, are you in sin? That's what the parable we'll get into here in a second. But if you are the source or the cause that is leading people to sin, right? So he says, if anybody leads these little ones to sin, but in contextually, he's associating that to us in the church. He says, you have to be like a little one to be enter the kingdom. Once you're in the kingdom and somebody starts leading you to sin, woe to them.
Yeah.
He says, it is better that a millstone is wrapped around their neck. If you belong to Christ and you're causing and you're the source of others to sin, that comes in many different forms. But if I could just maybe throw a few common ones I see, I mainly see this with women, but gossiping. You know, it's one of those things where I'm just talking with women, and Selena, you could probably speak to this far better than I can, but you know, a lot of women realize it's a problem for them. They'll show up and wake up in the day, and they're like, I'm not going to do that. And as soon as they get around, like, their friend at church, they're like, hey, did you see in here? And it just sucks them in, and they blah, 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 and they start gossiping, right?
Yeah.
We'll talk about that more in a second. But for somebody to initiate that in the church, gossip, that you're leading, that you're bring in and leading other women to start getting to engage in gossiping, right? And you start leading them into that sin. He says, that's a problem. He said, that is not okay, right? If you are the source of leading others into sin in the church, that's a very like small like case, but it's still serious, right?
No, it's still damaging.
What we've noticed it is like if someone was hurt by another church member, and that's just a way for them to have their feelings validated.
We've talked about a particular church member, and I recently tried to approach her about it, and she almost she wasn't even aware she was doing it, or she was like wanted all these examples to justify like why I said what I said, but we know people in the church that,
well,
it's like, hey, this is a, you got to stop doing this, because like you don't need to be putting your husband's things out there. You don't need to be putting these other, like, people are trusting you with these, with this information, because you're like a leader in the church. Like, you can't be saying that type of stuff.
Well, I think the problem is, and I don't want to make this about gossip, because it's
of course
not, it's about leading others. This is just the example, but often, you know, with gossip in particular, is people think, they don't think they're gossiping. They're thinking it's justice, right? Like they feel offended, or they're frustrated, and like, I'm not gossiping. I'm looking for help, or
yeah, like they've been wronged, and so
right. This is justice. This isn't me sinning. This is me holding other people to account.
I've seen people where they're just like,
no, that's not what, and this is what the whole point of Matthew 18 in this, the chapter of discipline, right? Because later Christ talks about the fact, this is how you deal with people who have offended you. None of which though include you gossiping about it.
Uh-huh.
He said, it's essentially two things. You either, if it is bothering you that much where you can't let it go, you go to them directly. You say, hey, what you said hurt me. Or this piece is frustrating me, right? This part is bothering me. But if you cannot take it to the person, you have to let it go.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the only two options Christ gives.
But it's like
gossiping
just
to other people and talking to other people about it is not one of the options he says, right?
Like they don't want that person just to know like you wronged me. They want other people to know like this person wronged me. And
it's not that just that I have a hurt from being wronged. It's I'm frustrated that there's not justice about the one who wronged me, right?
I mean, I also
and that bleeds into actually the parable next week. But
yeah, I was like, I usually see it more like maybe not usually, but the other like 50% of the time, it's they're like, I know something you don't know. It's like I got a secret, blah blah blah. It's like, do you want to know the secret? It's almost like childlike in a way.
I don't, and well, maybe you've seen that. I haven't seen.
I've seen that one a lot.
Have
where
you?
Yes, where
in the
just,
church.
Yes. And it's just kind of like, well, I didn't need to know that. I don't even know that person like that. And I didn't want to have that opinion of them. It's like, you know, it's like now you're framing or forming and causing me to form an opinion about that person when I only know what you told me about them.
That's
and
right.
Now that's damaging a relationship I could have had with that person.
So I don't, yeah. I haven't, I think everybody is at, I'm also, I guess, the chairman of deacon. So what happens is I think people are a little, tend to be more guarded. Sometimes when they're talking to, you know what I mean?
You're also very frank. You tell them to their face, like, you shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah, that's true.
It's like, hey, yo, stop.
Yeah, I am pretty like, hey, why stop that.
Yeah.
What are you doing, right? What I get here is more when people are hurt. So what I see is when people are hurt or frustrated or they feel like they've been wronged and they can't let it go, so that all they can do is talk about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk a lot more about that next week, but I think the bigger piece here, though, is that there's kind of like, Christ sets up, he's like, hey, it's one thing to sin, and it's one thing to lead others to sin, but it is a big, big deal when you start leading others who believe in me to sin. Those who have been, who've made a conscious decision of repentance to get out of sin and are actively working to combat sin, and now you're being a source of friction or enabler, or you're the roadblock in their life to feeding that and becoming a more sanctified saint, right? So he sets that up, and the family of God has much higher standards in the world. That's mm-hmm. the other thing people forget. People always like to compare actions of the church to actions of the world. Like, and here's honestly, if a corporation, if an HR department of a business is better at holding people accountable to these same principles than the church, something is wrong in the church.
Absolutely.
And I guess I forgot to preface it with this, but this whole Matthew 18 model, the manual of discipline, I very rarely see churches truly execute this the way Christ describes here.
Yeah.
And I'll say our church has. I don't think we do on, like, we could, I think every church can do much, much better in executing the Matthew 18 model of what it really says. I've seen our church actually execute it on some really big things, and this works. I'm saying Matthew 18 works phenomenally. If you are faithful to it.
Yeah.
People get scared though, because they are like, well, I don't want to, that doesn't sound loving. Like, well, hey, there's many.
You discipline your child when they mess up, right?
There's
and
many,
that is called love.
There's many attributes God has. Love is certainly one of them, but so is holiness and justice, right? And we don't hold people to the same account anymore. But we'll get to that in due time. So first, you need to be like little sheep to enter. Don't be the source of sin for, right?
Well, Selena does need to read the parable. So
we haven't got there yet.
No way.
No, hold on. We're still leading into it, okay? It's a short parable, though.
It is.
But the next thing, though, is that sometimes it is necessary to sacrifice sheep of the flock for the betterment of the flock.
What?
Here we go, verse 8. And if your hand or your foot causes you to sin, now we'll just, he's talking about what? A body, right now, right? Mm-hmm. Remember how Paul says we are all one body.
Yeah. Yep.
Right? And Christ uses a lot of the times if you're...
The church body.
If you're left... What's that?
Oh, church body.
The church body, right? Mm-hmm. Paul says that we are all one body. And he's when he was talking about, he's talking about gifts, and he's saying, like, you know, the eye doesn't tell the foot, you know, thinks itself better. It just, it plays two different functions to the holistic purpose of the body, right? Mm-hmm. So the church is often called, is referred to as one body, right? So he says, if your hand or your foot causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to enter life crippled or lame than with two hands or two feet to be thrown into the eternal fire. If your eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. It's better that you enter life with one eye than with two eyes to be thrown into the hell of fire. So essentially what he is saying, he's saying that sometimes it is necessary as a flock to keep the church holy, that you need to cut people off. They need to be cut out. Because if somebody who is leading, remember, because this is coming right off, if you're leading others, these little ones to sin, if you are leading church members, if somebody in the church is leading other church members into sin, it is better to get rid of them and lose the value and the talent and the gift that they possess and to walk around crippled for a while than for to let that person persist and corrupting
and corrupt everyone else.
Everyone else, so that the entire church body is eventually thrown into hell, right? Is essentially what he is saying. This is a very harsh teaching.
Yeah.
But this is Jesus. This isn't me. Like, if you open up your Bible, you'll see it's all the red text.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? This is all the red text. This is Jesus talking. So in other words, what he's saying is that there is a model for how you address this, but he sets a kind of a precedent. First, know that sometimes it's necessary that you need to cut people out and cut them away from your body, because it's better that you lose whatever function in the body they were serving than to have the whole body be led into sin, right? And we've seen this. There's been times we've had to cut people out of the church because they were leading in a very dangerous and drastic way, leading the entire body into sin, right? Now, does that mean that you're like, hey, I've noticed that there's been some gossiping in the church. I saw that you're the source of the gossiping. You're out. No.
Bruh.
Okay. The whole chapter, this is all leading, right? But he's giving us a teaching. Just know that first you have to be like little children or sheep to enter the kingdom. If you start leading others astray, if you start leading them to sin, hey, there's some judgment in that. And third, also know that as corporately, as a body, sometimes you have to cut members of the body off to keep the rest of the body healthy.
Yeah.
Right? You know, it's like Walking Dead. You guys ever watch Walking Dead?
I have not.
You have. I've seen a couple episodes of it.
So what happens if they get bit?
If you can catch it fast enough.
If you catch it fast enough and you chop off
the part appendage, of the body, it won't spread to the rest of the body.
It won't spread to the rest of the body. And it's the only hope you have of being, right? It's kind of like the same thing. Like if you have a zombie member, right, that is infecting the body, cut it off, cut that appendage off, let them go, because it's better for you to be crippled than and maybe have a hard time accomplishing the mission. And understand what we're talking about. Like, if everybody is really being like little children to enter the kingdom, that means that they are all participating in the functions. Everybody has a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So when you, for you to leave the body, ideally in the church, that should hurt the church.
Mm. Yeah.
Because we're losing something. We're losing a talent. We're losing a gift. We're losing, you know what I mean? When Imran and Selena leave Palms Church because the Marine Corps sends you somewhere else, that is going, it should. If you guys are doing what you should in the church, right? Mm. That should hurt the church.
Yeah.
That should be hard for us. That should be like, well, that's going to be hard to replace. You know what I'm saying? Because you have a gift and a talent for the church that once you leave is going to hurt the body, right? So now I would say this just real quick. If you're one of those people that where you leave the church and it doesn't hurt the church at all, you're not really engaging in the church the way you should be in the way Christ expects you to.
Probably take a look at what you're doing.
You know what I'm saying?
We were talking before this started that a lot of people, I can't be mentioned in here, that people go to church with the expectation the church is going to give them something.
Mm-hmm.
If that is your expectation, when you leave the church, they probably aren't feeling anything.
Right.
Because you're not participating in the body.
But per what Christ expects here is that that's already been established and understood that you're like a little one to be in the church and you're serving right in that way.
Yeah.
But the point is this, is that let's say with the gifts that Imran and Selena have, but then say Imran and Selena, you start like, hey, you know, I think we should really start incorporating crystals around the sanctuary to keep the negative energy out.
What about fog?
we could go down the fog rabbit hole at some point, but I'm saying something that you're like, why would we have crystals? Well, it's for the negative energy. And like, none of that is biblical. That's this new age spirituality stuff. Like, we're not doing that, right? And then we see that Imran and Selena, no matter how good you guys are at what you do, start pulling other church members into, you know, the crystals and, you know, and blah blah blah, and then we're like, hey, knock it off. That's not biblical. That is sin, and you're leading others into that. And you don't listen.
Mm-hmm.
As much as it would hurt, cut you off.
There was a,
because you're leading the body now into it. You see what I'm saying?
So I've learned this story over the past like year that I've been here. But prior to me getting here, apparently there was a worship leader that was here at the church, and the church was in a state of transition, and he was pretty knowledgeable about a lot of things. So he pointed the church towards getting the right sound equipment, towards getting the right speakers, towards getting some updated like lighting and stuff like that. But when you started peeling back the onion and looking at the team as a whole, this guy basically grew to be incredibly toxic. So when you look at what he did, he went up and adjusted all the lights in the ceiling, and he pointed all the lights at his position, like to the point where other areas of the stage were very darkened out, and it was not a good overall like flow, but he pointed them at his spot, so he was always lit. He had adjusted the sound in such a way that it prioritized him and prioritized how he sounded, and it hurt the other overall sound of the area. And he would make demands of the tech team that they weren't really able to do because they weren't really trained to do, and if they weren't able to do it, he would basically harass them and insult them for not doing things the way that he wanted them to be done and not doing them up to the standard that he had. There wasn't, over time, it was found that there wasn't really a love there for the church. It was very much a love for like his own view, his own perspective, and he wasn't willing to compromise or love as a team. So ultimately, that tech team and some of the other worship members like confronted him about it, and he went high into the right with denial, and then ultimately just like stopped coming to the church, but left the church in a state where his accounts were what was logged into most of their stuff. So they didn't have his password, so they couldn't get into some of the systems. To this day, we still have one more iPad that still has his account on it that we can't get in and we can't reset. And he denies any attempt of communication with us so that we can reset that stuff. Like, he's still harboring this animosity. So when they confronted him, he just essentially abandoned the church because he didn't believe he was doing these things, or he didn't want to fess up to it or want to get better. So there are people like that out there. If they didn't confront him and they're like, well, he's smart, he's helping us get the right stuff, he's helping us do these things, he did a lot of good, and it hurt when he left. But he was really harming the family, the relationships, the body,
you know,
because of his actions.
We've had some friction before with, I mean, in many different ways. But one was, I had to tell somebody, said, you're very talented, and we love the talent and the energy and the focus that you have. But don't think that talent will trump the unity of ministry. So I would rather have a horrible sounding sound on Sunday morning, or you know, fill in the blank, right?
Yeah.
I would rather have a decreased quality of video or of the online streaming, whatever. I'd rather have a decrease in that than have a disunity in the ministry there, because you want to be in the center or in control of it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And you know, that's true for a lot. And that's what Christ is saying here. He's saying it is better for the collective body to be unified moving forward wounded and incomplete than it is for it to be whole and yet being corrupted, and that the entire body then gets judged and led into sin, and then therefore judged and thrown into the fires of hell, right? Yeah. So I know that was kind of like a lot, but you just needed to understand how Christ was shaping this, because now we're about to get into the parable, right? So you need to be like a sheep or a little one, because right now he's going to talk about the sheep, which is the synonymous with the little ones, right? Mm-hmm. You must be like a little one to enter the kingdom. You better not be a source that leads those in the church to sin. And sometimes it is necessary to sacrifice members of the body for the betterment of the body, right? But now with that said, how then, because Jesus is very aware of how people could receive this if grace is not explicitly given, how does grace apply to this, right? So he first says there is standards and there is repercussions and consequences for standards, and there's an expectation that if there's no repentance or someone's leaning to sin, they're out. But there's also an expectation of grace and love in this. So he starts to kind of do the balancing act, right? First sets the expectation. There is times where you're going to have to cut off members of the body. But before that happens, here's the model of grace and love that you apply first, okay? Mm-hmm. So now with that all said, we can get into our parable.
Well, I'm really glad you did the introduction, because I've always read this chapter as like individualistic. Like when it's talking about like cut off your arm and stuff like that, it's like, okay, like what are you struggling with? And you yourself have to remove that part of yourself. So I've always seen it like not as the whole body of church. This is the first time I've heard it taught that way.
Yeah.
So thank you for that. Mm-hmm. So we're going to go ahead and read from Matthew chapter 18, verses 10 to 14. See that you do not despise one of these little ones, for I tell you that in heaven, their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven. What do you think? If a man has 100 sheep and one of them has gone astray, does he not leave the 99 on the mountains and go in search of the one that went astray? And if he finds it, truly I say to you, he rejoices over it more than over the 99 that never went astray. So it is not the will of my Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish.
All right, Selena, thank you for reading that. And I know that was a long introduction, but I think it was a good conversation. So with that, I'll hand off to Ryan to get us into, I don't think it'll be our first point or even our second point, but whatever's the next point.
Yeah, we're just talking about it.
Yeah.
So, okay. So when Jesus sets the expectation, like, hey, it's a big deal if you're like a little one who are brought into the kingdom and you're leading them to sin. He said, that's a big deal. And there comes times where you're going to have to cut people out of the body for the better health of the body. But then he kind of, in this parable here, though, he shows first like God's heart with people who belong to the flock, right? Now switches the mode over to this parable of the church is like a flock, right? With him being the good shepherd. And he demonstrates his heart for those who do go astray. But also secondly, though, notice he's talking about those who go astray, not to those who lead others astray. So this is about a sheep who has now wandered off from the flock, not about a sheep that is leading other sheep to wander off, right? Mm-hmm. So now we're talking about those who are just like by themselves or starting to wander, but not necessarily leading others, okay? So to understand that, the first thing he says, you know, he pretty much gives us what God's heart is, which is if you have a flock of sheep and one of them goes off, are you not going to still go chase after the one who's going astray?
I would have to ask my father.
As our hearts should be as a church for those who are starting to go astray.
Yeah.
Those who, and you see this a lot. You see people who kind of come in and they're on fire and you know, they're going to Bible study and they don't miss a Sunday and they're getting involved and engaged and they're serving, and they know that whatever they were just saved out of or what they left was empty, and it was not satisfying or gratifying or honoring, right? And then as time kind of goes on, though, you know, they sometimes start to go astray again. And do we just let them go? Right. Well, they're in sin. You know, do we just let them go? No. He says, do you not go after them? So he's trying to tell us that for those who are going astray, he's not talking about the ones who lead others astray, but those who just go astray on their own, chase after them, bring them back. Right. And again, I want you to note, it says that the flock is who? The church.
Yep.
And he's talking about a sheep within the flock that has already gone. So we're not talking about people in the world. Okay, we're not talking about those who do not belong to the church yet. You know, we're not talking about them. We are talking about those who are already part of the flock, but who are now going astray and wandering from the flock, right? Yeah. That's who we're talking about. We're talking about church members, believers who are going astray. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
If I could give a different, kind of two different, what is the word I'm looking for? Make a differentiation? That's not a word.
Comparison? Metaphor?
Yeah, let me compare it to Luke. Whatever I'm trying to say.
Approach from a different perspective?
So Luke places this parable in his gospel as part of a triple parable. It's really interesting. So Luke places this parable as with the parable of the prodigal son, the woman in the lost coin, and the parable of the lost sheep. And if you guys remember from 2 weeks ago when we were talking about there's things as double parables, triple parables, where you have multiple parables all to the same point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this is part of a triple parable in terms of Luke's construction that we see. And
they're all further clarifying the same point.
Yes, which is really demonstrating God's heart as demonstrated. It's really interesting. It's summarizing God's heart for us that had been communicated in the book of Psalms. So interesting thing. God is presented three ways in the book of Psalms. You know what it is? He's the good shepherd, a father, and a woman. Those are the three ways that God has presented himself in the book
of Psalms.
That
really hit me with that Ariana Grande song, God is a Woman, that just like, boop, right in my head. There's an Ariana Grande song, God is a Woman. Don't worry about it.
Okay. Yeah, I missed that. And just for clarification, God is asexual.
Yeah.
Okay.
God doesn't have reproductive organs.
So, but the way it is presented, right? So when you get to Luke, the triple parable, which is you got, you know, the woman in the lost coin, and what she does to seek after that lost coin, the prodigal son, the father who, no matter how many times his son leaves and dishonors him, he chases after him when he comes returning. And then the parable of the lost sheep here, the good shepherd, right? So that's how Luke constructs it. But Matthew takes a different approach. Matthew uses this as showing how Christ is a fulfillment of Ezekiel 34. So in Ezekiel 34, because remember, this is a very Jewish gospel. You know, Matthew is. So it's to a Jewish audience, using Jewish principles with Jewish thought. But if I can kind of just read through this, it says, the word of the Lord came to me, Ezekiel, because it's Ezekiel 34. Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say to them, even the shepherds, thus says the Lord God, shepherds of Israel, who have been feeding yourselves, should not shepherds feed the sheep? You eat the fat, you clothe yourselves with wool, you slaughter the fat ones, but you do not feed the sheep. Now, we already know who's the sheep, right?
Us.
Believers, right? And in this case, Israel, the people of Israel, when we're talking about the religious authority. The weak you have not strengthened, the sick you have not healed, the injured you have not bound up, the strayed you have not brought back, right? Those who have gone astray, you have not brought back. The lost you have not sought, and with force and harshness you have ruled them. So they were scattered because there was no shepherd, and they became food for all the wild beast. My sheep were scattered. They wandered over all the mountains and on every hill. My sheep were scattered over all the face of the earth with none to search or seek for them.
It sounds like the book of Lamentations.
But you see what he's...
they talk about Israel being destroyed. It's like, oh gosh.
But you see what he's associating here in terms of the parable.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying that the religious authority up to this point, you have let them wander.
Yeah.
You've let them go into sin. You've let them scatter across, and the shepherd has been worried about the shepherd himself. You've cared very little for the sheep. And now we're in this ridiculous situation, right? And I could just say this, just because it's talking about Israel, we like to be like, oh, those religious authorities. But I could just say this about the modern American church, many churches who have failed to actually chase after those who have wandered, who have failed to hold those accountable. We've let people scatter across.
That's why we're currently failing. We're in this state now.
We could be repeating this exact same mistake as a church.
Yeah.
Verse 7, it says, therefore, you shepherds, hear the word of the Lord. As I live, declares the Lord God, surely because my sheep have become a prey and my sheep have become food for all the other wild beasts, since there was no shepherd, and because my shepherds have not searched for my sheep, but the shepherds have fed themselves and have not fed my sheep. Therefore, you shepherds, hear the word from the Lord. Behold, I am against the shepherds, and I will require my sheep at their hand and put stop to their feeding of the sheep. No longer shall the shepherds feed themselves. I will rescue my sheep from their mouths, and they may not be food for them. And then the whole next piece of 11 through like 24 of Ezekiel is talking about how God is going to actively seek his sheep. I will search for my sheep. As a shepherd seeks out his flock when he is among his sheep that have been scattered, so I will search my sheep. I will rescue them from the places where they have scattered, right? So the whole point is that, like, go read Ezekiel 34.
If you're
reading this parable, go read Ezekiel 34 and understand that first he's talking about the failures of the religious authority to properly shepherd the flock. And because they have failed, Christ says, that is not me. That is not God. So because you, i.e. church, who are now going to belong to me, you do not repeat the same failure that they had. This, by the way, I don't know if I mentioned it before, but Matthew 18 is the first time Jesus uses the word church, ecclesia, in his teaching.
Oh.
It's also interesting, is the first time he refers to it is when he's talking about confronting sin in the church. So the first command he gives the ecclesia is confront sin in the church. That's also paired with, you know, sometimes you're going to have to cut people all out of the body. You better be searching for those who go astray in the church. All these, right, this manual of discipline for the church that he's giving, he's essentially saying, you do not repeat the same failures that the religious authority had done before I came. This is the heart of God. We search after those sheep when they go astray.
Yeah.
Our goal is not to kick people out of the church. Our goal is to seek them out, disciple them, make them better. But if they don't change or they cannot repent, cut them off. Be good shepherds, right? If you find a wolf among you, get rid of the wolf, mm-hmm. right? Like he's saying, we need to be good shepherds. And if the failure to be a good shepherd, just because you just want to feed yourself, you notice how he kept saying you didn't shepherd people, you just wanted to feed yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Per what we were talking about earlier, when people show up to church and they just want to feed themselves but never feed others.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
I want to insert a little admin note here. I think one of the best things I learned coming out of North Coast Church, which is another, you know, it's a pretty big church over there on the coast, but they're pretty awesome.
In Vista, California.
Yeah, in Vista, California. But I remember that pastor, at the beginning of almost every sermon, he would say that as I'm teaching today, the temptation's going to be that you look at this, I look at the Bible from the perspective of using binoculars, and you're going to look through these binoculars, and you're going to look at everyone around you, and you're going to say, wow, woe is them. They're so bad. They're so out of place. Don't do that. Look at the Bible like it's a mirror. You can only affect what you individually have access to and can control. And so when you're listening to what we're talking about today, the temptation is going to be there to be like, oh, the American church is all blah, blah, blah. Oh, woe is the world, oh, blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, you can take action as an individual within the body to get after these things, to seek out the lost within your church, because I'm sure you're aware of some, and maybe you're the one gossiping instead of doing something about it. Well, so use this
let's talk about the temptations.
Use this as a mirror.
Because just note here, God shows that he doesn't care for the marginalized, just those who are outside of the kingdom, right? One, he's talking about Israel as a whole, mm-hmm. that they're like sheep that are just scattered everywhere and they're being devoured by wild beasts because the shepherds who were appointed over them didn't do their job. Oh, yeah. He's like, I'm coming. I'm the good shepherd. I'm going to now take what is scattered. I'm going to seek them out. I'm going to bring them in, right? The marginalized outside, bring them back in. But then he also cares for the marginalized who are within the flock, right? And I think much of the church temptations is this. Don't you notice how easy it is to be a Christian to those who are easy to love?
Yep.
So when we talk about being practical to the gospel, when other people are faithful to the gospel and they're loving and they're well-liked and put together and not difficult, it's really easy to forgive people like that. It's very easy to serve people like that when they're in hard times. And, you know, if they come down, like when it comes to maybe they need money, like, hey, that's easy because we know them.
Mm-hmm.
They're very lovable. But I think the temptation of the church is the unlovable people in church. I don't mean unlovable in the sense that they're unlovable. I mean in the sense that they're not.
Maybe they have some personality flaw. Maybe they're more awkward. Maybe they're more quiet.
Difficult.
Like, are you going to, or maybe you are aware that they're struggling with something, and instead of going to maybe pursuing them, you're just kind of gossiping or talking about it. Or just
so it says, the one that leaves the 99 for the one. You know, and sometimes we despise, and I don't necessarily despise, but we don't engage with them in the same because they're different, right? They're one. They're loners. Mm-hmm. They're kind of strange, or they're different,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's not that I think people are doing it to be mean. It's just we don't engage them in the same way, or because they're more difficult when it comes to helping them, there's almost like it takes more grace, so it's harder for us to do it, right? Because it's like, man, they're so difficult. Now they need money, and it's like there's always something with these people. Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. But those are the people that come into the church. Those are the ones that you need to help. And the temptation is that we make a good old boys club or a good old girls club that turns into a mean girls club for those people.
And that's who you're ostracizing, the one you're supposed to be pursuing. Right.
And the reason that they wander from the flock is because the flock had already kind of segregated themselves from and closed them off, right? What also says that, remember it says that you need to be like the little ones. You need to be like sheep to enter the kingdom. Well, if that is true, that means that we are talking about people who tend to be dependent, right? It's actually, in many regards, the very independent ones, the non-difficult people. You know, the reason they're that way, and it's not that it's bad that they're that way, but there's also with that, though, comes the kind of a character that could develop into pride sometimes. Mm. You know what I mean? Like there's a certain type of person who is always very well put together, very, very well taken care of, not in a lot of needs of things. You know what I mean? But they
haven't lived the life yet.
No, I wouldn't say that.
I would say that. There's some people that I've met where it's like they've not experienced, I would say, like real strife. Just things have been kind of handed to them.
Well, that
all
I mean,
life.
Or maybe they just present themselves.
I think there's people who are very successful in life who came from bad situations, but because they're very successful, they're not difficult in church, right? Like they're not the people who are asking for benevolence, and they're not the people who, you know, they're the people who are tithing. You know, they're pouring in. They're the people who are serving, not causing drama. Like there's a lot of really good people, but that also comes with it, though, that you can start seeing a sense of pride in people like that, where there's other people who are more dependent and they're more difficult. They're emotionally needy, or you know what I mean? And you're just like, they're not as emotionally needy as I am. And they're exhausting. And the temptation is that they're the one, and they'll tend to wander. And you see the people wander from church to church to church. Well, why are they wandering from church to church to church? Because each one of those families, they've kind of like pushed them out. You know what I mean? The other thing is that there's also the fact that they're going astray because of their sin. So we've talked about this recently, but you know, even last week, but the idea is that I guess I could say it this way. Sometimes I think we show more grace to people outside the church than we do to people inside the church. So if a woman were to show up to the church, a teenager who's maybe pregnant, but not a believer.
Mm-hmm. Just asking for help.
Just asking for help, we would pour, I think most would pour an enormous amount of grace on this, on that woman, right? Yeah. teenager within the church, grew up in the church, parents go to the church, part of the youth group, gets pregnant as a teenager. Do you think the same amount of grace is always? Well, I mean, a lot of times, what
that
happens
gossip
is
that starts, that ostracization starts, that
the gossip starts. The and you know what I'm saying. There's a lot of
assumptions and all these things,
right? So then, what happens is, and they go back and they say, "I remember the way I was treated when I was a teenager, pregnant, scared, afraid, and alone in the family." That
it's like when I needed the family,
right? Instead, they gossiped about me. They hurt me. They did all these things. And they go astray, and then they get further disconnected from the church, and then go deeper and deeper and deeper, right? And Christ says, mm-hmm. "No, go seek them out, bring them back, love them, right? Love them." And you know, Paul's whole model, by the way, with church, is different than the way we've adopted it. Paul's model is that you make disciples, you make people so attractive to the world that the world is gravitates to the church.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the church is so attractive, the people, that they want to come here to the church to be with those people. And what we've done, you brought up fog machines earlier. What we have done is, because slowly over time, we have made the Christian less attractive, we have to make church attractive.
Yeah.
So now we need the coffee bars. We need the fog machines. We need the laser shows for worship. We need all these things to entice people to come.
They even go out of their way to make sure it's like very beautiful people on stage. Like on some of these much bigger churches, like Hillsong comes to mind. Like their whole worship team is just like,
well, Hillsong.
Barn
did you see that documentary?
I did.
We don't need to go down that.
Yeah.
I'm just saying. The point though,
corporate
is,
church
is
at
that
its finest.
Because what the church was supposed to be was the Christian was meant to be attractive. And because the Christian's not as attractive anymore, I don't mean physically attractive.
Yeah, you don't mean physically attractive.
I mean in terms of character. Because the Christian is no longer as attractive, we have to make the church itself attractive, church service attractive, so we can attract people to come, right?
Yeah.
That was never the model, right? And the way you attract people in character is that when they need the family rallies and they bring them in, right?
Yeah.
We were talking about last week in terms of how Christ decided, here's your situation, I choose to help first. And then we could talk about position after, right? It's relational before it was positional. It's the same way here where it's like, you need to be relational with every one of them and not simply positional in terms of their sin, right? Like,
I think that you can really easily arc this towards like the military, because the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps had an interview with the Marine Times in the last like 3 or 4 months. And they asked him, it's like, what are you trying to do to make people stay in the Marine Corps? What are you trying to do to manage talent? And he said, chiefly among all the things we're trying to do, people don't stay in the Marine Corps for the money. People don't stay in the Marine Corps because of the suck and all that. They stay in the Marine Corps because they want to be Marines. They stay in the Marine Corps because there is an ideal associated with being a Marine, and they want to be associated to it.
I think that's such an out of touch view.
I'll be honest.
I'm sorry.
There's
a reason why the best talent leaves, and this is a good. I'm going to associate this back to the church.
That was the first half of the point, because the other part to it is that he said that so we should continue to work on making like the Marine Corps that ideal, because I like my best Marines got out of the Marine Corps because something about the Marine Corps hurt them. They thought it was this. The commercial said it was this, and all these things. But then when it came time for the command to step up and help their family, or the command to step up and make sure that they were taken care of, they didn't. They felt abandoned. They felt that their
I could tell you
their staff didn't stand with them, and so they were like, "Well, I don't want to be a part of this organization anymore."
Mission, culture, leadership. Those three things, which is why the best leave.
Yeah.
Right. And the same goes though in terms of the church. If we do not communicate and people don't understand the true mission of the church, and we have a culture of the church that again shows less grace to those who are within it than outside, where it should be applied equally, right?
Yep.
Mission, culture, and then if the leadership of the church, just like what Christ is going after here, failed shepherds. We don't shepherd people.
Yeah.
right? Failed shepherding. That's why people leave.
Yeah. You know, and that was the Sergeant Major's point. He was saying that we have to get after these things to get people to stay. We can try and work all this talent management I've and giving bonuses and stuff, but
that's like, all another discussion, and that's outside of the scope, I guess, here. Sure. But the thing, though, if I could just kind of, because we got to wrap this up, because this is going to be like part one, I guess. Next week will be a different parable, but it's all Matthew 18. Yeah. Because this is all kind of like a systematic for Christ on this right now, right? Like, you need to be like little ones. Don't lead them astray. If you do, cut them out.
Uh-huh.
It's better to be lame as a church body than to have the whole church body be led into the fire, right? Third, those who go astray, chase after them. And, you know, with that piece there, before we get in, we'll get into the rest of it next week. But what he ultimately demonstrates, what our heart should be, and what God demonstrates his heart should be, is one of patient love, one of seeking love, one of protecting love, a rejoicing love. It says that he rejoices when they come back, right? Like, mm-hmm. Do we rejoice the way when somebody does go astray and they end up coming back to church? Like, man, I haven't seen you in a couple of years, right? What's been going on? And you've realized they've gone astray. But do we rejoice at the fact that they're back? Or are we kind of more like, so?
Was up with that?
Been going living in the dumpster for a little bit, have we? Like, you know what I mean? Do we rejoice at their back? And then also his individual love, right? He left the 99 for the one. It's that there is a corporate love for the church, a corporate love that the shepherd has for the flock, right?
Yeah.
But he has the individual seeking love for the one that goes astray. I don't think we talked about it, but in this parable, he says, what is it, about 100, right? That's a pretty, what he's talking about is a pretty wealthy shepherd. Mm-hmm. So I think it was Job who had 14,000.
I think it was like 16,000. It was ridiculous.
Wow. Thousands of sheep, right?
That's unnecessary.
We're not talking about wealth like Job, but we are talking about a decent flock, right? He's talking about a church.
Job had 14,000. You were right.
Yeah, so he's talking about a church that is healthy, a church that is, plentiful, if you will, right? We're not talking about a small flock, a small church, or necessarily a mega church like Job, but he's painting this as a decently sized church. And he's saying, when one leaves, you can maybe even afford to let that one go astray and leave because you got 99 others. But he says, no, each and every single one of them is valuable. Seek after them. And if as a church you do not have a process or a structure to chase, right? I guess you could call it,
I think that's important,
a chasing to define ministry, that there. Right? Like, how do you chase? You know, and right now I would say what often happens is you're just thinking about somebody, you're like, hey, where do they go? Like, I don't know, who do they hang out with? And you call them, hey, you know what's going on with them? Or no, I don't know. Well, hey, when you want to reach out to them or let me know, maybe I should give them a call or, right? Like, but again, that assumes, though, that they are engaged actively in the flock, in the church, to know that they're leaving.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? The problem is, and this is, you know, people are kind of funny because of that consumer mindset of church, is they can leave and like, well, nobody reached out to us. Nobody even realized we weren't here. Well, beyond Sunday, like, did you show up to Bible study on Tuesdays? Do you serve, like, in Awana on Wednesday or in the nursery on Sundays? Or like, do you have a circle in the church?
Yeah.
Because if all you're doing is showing up on Sunday, then leaving and not engaging at all, how are people supposed to get to know you?
And how would people even know that you left? You know, if you snuck in the door and snuck out.
But because it's a consumer mindset, and then they're like, well, we haven't even gone back and nobody's even noticed. Like, and it's a very egocentric type of faith.
Yeah.
So I would just say from the very get-go,
this family isn't for you. You're for this family.
Right. If you want to be chased after, right, you need to be an active part of the flock. You know what I mean? And so there's a lot of elements with this parable, I think, that highlights both individually but collectively, corporately as a church, just like an understanding of this is, and you know, and if you're not a church leader, but you have a church, you know, one of the things you should be looking for is, what does church accountability look like here? What does the church discipline look like here? Do they actually practice and execute? Because some say, hey, we follow Matthew 18, but do they really follow Matthew 18?
Yeah.
You know, one of the things,
something happens, like, what do they actually do about it?
We'll get into the rest of it next week, but when we started talking about the personal sin, right? So one was, must be like little ones, must be like sheep. Number two was that if you lead people in the church astray into sin, it's like there's some big judgment and you will get cut off, kicked out, essentially, right?
Yep. Number three, better be.
Number three is that, which is the parable of the lost sheep, that if those who go astray, you need to chase after them. Seek after those people. Don't let them go.
Yeah.
Right? If they not that they're being led away, but that they are going astray on their own, go seek after them, bring them back, right? Next week, we're going to talk about what happens when those in the church sin against each other. How do you handle that?
Oh, man.
And then, and then what is the extent of how many times I should allow that's myself to be offended or for people to go astray for me to chase. So that's what we'll hit next week.
All right. Did you have any final comments, Selena? You're reading a little bit there.
No, that was good.
Okay. Thank you so much, Ryan. This has been good. I want to echo Selena's point too, that I didn't understand that the context of Matthew 18 is talking more about the church as a body, as a whole. But I really appreciate that additional perspective because it does, now it makes more sense. Like, like in all honesty, like it makes more sense instead of hearing like two or three verses at a time, you look at the whole sermon as a whole and it makes more sense. It's like, okay, that's what he's talking about. So, if you enjoyed this, please make sure you're taking note. If you're in the 29 Palms area, please come check us out over at Palms Baptist Church so we can love on you and worship with you. So go into this week and just continue to study, look around for opportunities to continue to dive into the Word, right? It's not just a Sunday morning thing. It's a lifestyle. It's a life choice, and it's something we're called to pursue. So we love you and hope you enjoy your week.
Thank you for tuning in to Real Bible Stories. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to leave a review, share, and subscribe to be notified each week when we upload new episodes. Real Bible Stories is produced in partnership with Palms Church in 29 Palms, California. If you would like more information or want to check out archived sermons and Bible studies, please check out the church website at palmsbaptistchurch.com. Or check them out on Facebook, Instagram, or YouTube. Real Bible Stories can be found wherever podcasts are found. Thank you again, and we will see you next week.